What I'm going to do today is I'm going to continue the kind of the series that I started and sort of indicated that I would try to cover down on for the rest of the year as I got opportunity. And so I'll just kind of give a background on how that started for those of you that weren't here on the first section that I did in January. So I was explaining back then that I consider part of my fatherly duties to be to go into Brenna, you know, our family Google Plus account, to just to peruse the, you know, what's been out there, what's been being said by her friends and posts, and I stumbled across this one that one of her friends had posted entitled 10 Things You Can't Do and Still Call Yourself Pro-Life. And so I just I clicked on it and opened up the article, and it had this list of 10 things, and we'll talk about it briefly. I'll show you the whole list today. You've seen it before in January. So I had this 10 list of things that the author was saying that you couldn't believe in, basically, and still call yourself pro-life. And the whole point of his article was that the term pro-life, he considered it having been co-opted just to talk about the abortion topic. So that people who are against abortion are pro-life, and those who are not are pro-choice. And he thought that the whole point of his article was to expand the purpose of the term pro-life to encompass other types of things that he considered important. And it's kind of interesting when we talk about Noah, we talk about all these other types of things, the way culture, and this has always happened, the way culture kind of encompasses the Bible, and we come up with beliefs and perceptions based off of cultural types of things, but not necessarily focused upon the Bible. And so I'd shared in January the first time that as I read through his list of 10 things, I immediately discounted quite a few of them. And then I started to think about, well, why did I discount them? And really, a lot of it came back to I discounted them because I grew up in a culture of living here in the United States, a conservative culture in my family. And so many of the things that I immediately discounted from his list were things that challenged me the more I read back through it. And so I thought, well, it might be a good opportunity to maybe go through this list. And I wasn't really necessarily looking at it as a topic for a sermon, but it just kind of developed into that. The guy's name was Mr. Benjamin Corey. And so so what we did, the first lesson back in January, we talked about abortion, and I won't go into really any detail there other than to say that it's on the webpage. And I thought I definitely disagreed with his take on abortion, and I won't go into any of the reasons why. But the interesting thing about him is that it indicated on his blog that he was a seminary student. So at some point he's planning to enter the ministry of some degree. And so that just, I guess, maybe was one more reason why I thought, well, I was interested in the things that he had written and then really trying to tie them back to the Bible. And so today, the topic, you can go to the next first slide. And one more. Okay, so this is the list of the 10 things that Benjamin Corey had put up there. And I was originally planning to try to get through number 9 and number 8 on the list. So number 10, as I mentioned, was he said you could not support unrestricted elective abortions after the age of viability. And we talked about why really, I guess we'll give a short summary, why the age of viability is really a non-existent term, that God makes it very clear that from conception, life begins at conception. So there is no magical age of viability, that birth or life begins at conception. God considers abortion to be murder at any point beyond that, because God is the giver of life, the author of life, and as men, we are not authorized in his take to take that away. Number 9 and number 9 on his list was you cannot oppose a livable minimum wage. And I'll tell you right off the bat, right there I went, seriously? But then, really, I thought a lot about it. That's the one we're going to talk about today. And I intended to wrap number 8 in there, which is you cannot advocate, support, or passively tolerate economic policies which oppress the poor, minorities, or any other marginalized group. And honestly, this week has been it's been pretty full with our travel to Montana for a speech and debate tournament. And I had a big long list of verses, and I read them quite a bit over the week. And I was trying to figure out how to wrap it all into a message. And then, we got home last night, and I thought I could kind of outline it, and I'd be able to cover both topics, and it would be good. And it kind of reminded me when I was, as we were driving up and we were driving back, I was listening to a couple guys I'm James McDonald. He's a pastor out of Illinois. I'm John MacArthur, pretty popular pastor. And I've listened to them, and honestly, it was kind of building a little anxiety in me as I was going. I was like, well, those guys are so good. And Steve, when he teaches, and Pat. So there was a little anxiety there. And then, Marion shares this morning that they just listened to Chuck Hagee, who's also a very excellent pastor. And but then it reminded me of something that John MacArthur had said when he was talking. One of the things I was listening to him, he was doing a lesson on heaven. He talked about on heaven, everything's going to be perfect. So we will never, when we do a task in heaven, at the end of it, his take on it is that we'll never stop and go, oh, man, I wish that would have been better. And so here's a guy who's probably, I don't know John MacArthur. He's been a pastor for 40 years plus, so he's, thousands and thousands of sermons. And he said, honestly, I've never preached a sermon where I got done and I thought, that's exactly what I was hoping for. That's really what I wanted it to be. So as good as he is, he's always figured, now God has used it. He said, he's important to share that it's, God uses the words. And I can't tell how many times we've sat in here and listened to Steve talk about something, and Marianne has elbowed me and said, did you tell Steve about that or something? And no conversation happened there. It's the Holy Spirit. And so we'll try to use God's word today to talk about this topic. And it is sort of cultural, but really it's important because there's a lot of the church that's beginning to focus a lot on these types of cultural issues. And so is that bad or is that good? I'm not going to necessarily make a judgment on that, but it is part of our discussions. And so today, if you can go to the next slide for me, Lisa, please. Our topic is number 9, that you cannot oppose a livable minimum wage, according to Mr. Benjamin Corey, and still say, call yourself pro-life. And so I just want to go through a couple of the couple things on here. This kind of outlines his. He doesn't give a whole lot of detail on why he believes some of these things. But here's some of the key notes that he had there. He indicated that after adjustments for inflation, the minimum wage today is $2 less an hour than it was in 1968. That was interesting. So our buying power at the minimum wage, which right now is $7.25 an hour in the country, across the country, there are quite a few localities in some states where they have upped that, but right now it's $7.25 an hour at the federal level. And so that buying power on that, though, is actually $2 less an hour per the study. And so he got his information from an organization called the Restaurant Opportunities Centers United. And I'm not familiar with them, but just so, he provided that the statistics that he provides here came from that organization. The other interesting thing that he put in the summary was that simply raising the federal minimum wage from the current $7.25 an hour to $10 an hour would lift 58% of the working poor of our country out of poverty. So when I looked at those, I thought, those statistics really do paint a fairly bleak picture of for workers who work for the minimum wage of, of where we are as a country. And it's, it's become more of a political issue across the board. It's really kind of a hot button topic now. President Obama indicated in his State of the Union address to Congress and the country not that long ago that he was advocating an increase in the minimum wage to $10, kind of along the lines of what Benjamin Corey had here in his, which predated the president's address. And he also has put into place an executive order within the federal government that any contractor, anybody working for the federal government, if they were not already at the federal or a minimum wage of $10, that would be put into place. So that was an executive order that went into law. And so that has brought up a lot of discussion. And you can listen to any talk radio, you can read the newspaper. There was articles just even recently. There's a lot of articles out there. And really, it's on either side of the political spectrum. If you don't agree with minimum wage or the government participating in the free market economy of sorts, then people will look at studies, and there's plenty of studies out there that indicate that a minimum wage doesn't actually bring people out of poverty and that all it does is cause loss of jobs. And if you do believe in that, then there are studies out there that indicate that, it doesn't really harm and that it will, in fact, bring some people up and out of the poverty level. And so it's one of those things where I'm not sure who it was out there that indicated that you can make statistics say pretty much anything that you want them to say. And so the whole point of today, though, is not really to talk about and to make arguments for or against the federal minimum law or minimum wage and whether there should be. The whole point of today is to talk about this, and is this a spiritual issue? Is this something that we as a church should be involved in outside of our individual beliefs as it relates to economics? And that brings me to that question. Is it a spiritual issue, and should the church have a position? And then finally, can a Christian oppose government interference in the workplace and still be called pro-life? Because that is Benjamin Corey's assertion here on his list, that you cannot oppose the minimum wage increase and call yourself pro-life. So since I didn't know the organization that he pulled his statistics from, the Restaurant Opportunity Centers United, I did a little research on my own and ended up finding this information here that you'll see, and it's from Pew Research Corporation. So I'm familiar with them and their work in general, and feel like they're fairly responsible and representative group as far as pulling data. And so I went to some of their research to determine what it was that they had to say. And before I go into the information that's on the chart there, there are some of the things that Drew Silver, who is the author of the study for Pew Research, he kind of said some things that I thought I would highlight. The interesting thing that he started was that perhaps surprisingly, not very many people earn the minimum wage. And so, because I guess that's one of the things you think about when you think of the minimum wage, you assume that there is a huge population of people within the United States that are at the minimum wage. And so he pulled out the numbers and said that they actually make up a smaller share of the workforce than they used to. Then he pulled some Bureau of Labor Statistics, and that last year, so in the year 2012 is the data he has, 1.56 million hourly workers earned the federal minimum of $7.25 an hour. So 1.5 million workers in the United States. And then there's nearly 2 million more that earn less than that because they fell under one of several exemptions. So there are exemptions out there within federal labor laws for tipped employees, so waiters, waitresses, full-time students, certain disabled workers, and some others. And so the grand total of workers, employees within the United States that are at the federal minimum or below, if they're in one of those categories where they receive exemptions, is about 3.5 million. That was quite a bit less. I guess I never really thought about the number, but it seemed to be less than what I thought. And so with his numbers up here, then kind of his analysis here, on the left is the chart. And the chart kind of shows the real earnings of the federal minimum wage starting back in so 1940, really when it, or just before 1940 when it started. And see, back in the late 60s, kind of when the earning power of the minimum wage has increased, maxed, and it's kind of dropped back down. So real wages, about 2012 or their timeline, so they come together automatically. But you can see from the chart that, in fact, you know, based off what Benjamin Corey indicated, the minimum wage in the purchasing power at that is slowly starting to decrease, which supports the research that he showed. But the interesting thing that you see on the comments there, so the people at or below the federal minimum wage are disproportionately young. So 50% are the ages 16 to 24, and 24% of the total number are teenagers ages 16 to 19. So that was pretty interesting that, you know, really over or about half of the people that are at the federal minimum wage are people that are just starting their working careers. And that seems reasonable. We know that a lot of people, you know, start a lot of kids in high school and those type of things, work at minimum wage types of jobs. We just happened to, on our way back from Montana yesterday, stopped at Subway, and the guy who was helping make our sandwiches was indicating that he was going to college, so he was working at Subway while he's going to college there in Pocatello. And I assume his long-term plans once he graduates is not to stay there at Subway, unless he plans to own it or manage it. But so you see 50% are that younger age group, mostly 78% white, and fully half of the people at the federal minimum wage are white women. And then 64% of that total is part-time workers. So once again, that makes sense, that the majority of people who are working at these jobs, that it is a part-time job. It's either a filler or somebody that's pulled that job in order to make up some extra income for someone else in their home that may, so they may, you know, they may be looking for alternate sources of income. I think that helps build a bigger picture of the overall picture of that. And then they work in the industries that indicates there that you might expect, and these are just bullets I pulled out of there. So just over half, 51%, work in the leisure and hospitality industry, which meant about 1.5 million of those were in the food service industry, which would be fast foods, the Subways, McDonald's, and those types of things. And then another 16%, or 546,000, worked in retail sales. So that would be different stores as cashiers and those types of things. So of the 3.5 million, we see that those two categories, about 2 million are in the food services and retail sales. Then you see 9% in education and health services, and then the rest scattered throughout some other sectors. So that was, I just thought that gave a better picture than just saying that, talking about economic, pushing people down economically and holding them down. I thought it gave a different picture, really, than what I expected to see. And then Pew Research's conclusion was that economists continue to debate the extent to which minimum wage laws reduce poverty, income equality, and/or overall employment. What's clear, though, is that after a three-step increase in 2007 to 2009, today's minimum wage buys more than it did recently, but its real purchasing power is about where it was four decades ago and below its late 1960s peak. So, if you believe in the minimum wage, it has not kept up with what it was intended to do. The purchasing power has continued to decline. And so so that just kind of gave, I thought, a snapshot of the entire picture. So that leads back to the question that I asked to start with: is the minimum wage a spiritual issue? And so I tried to do a little research and just on the web searching for some opinions of people. And I found an article by this man named Ron Franklin. He's a pastor at Covenant Community Church in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And the headline of his article that I found was, "Is the Minimum Wage a Spiritual Issue?" And Ron shares that he was reading through Amos chapter 8, verses 4 through 7, and the verses are right here. And as he read that, he said he was writing in his journal afterwards. So all great stuff, certainly something Steve has talked about many, many times, to read God's Word and then have to write down those things that God brings to mind. And so so he was writing in his journal, he said, and that he had some comments there, and you see the comments right below the verses. And so let me read the verses first. So it's Amos chapter 8, verses 4 through 7. It says, "Hear this, you who trample the needy and do away with the poor of the land, saying, 'When will the new moon be over, and we may sell grain, and the Sabbath be ended, that we may market wheat?' Skimping the measure, boosting the price, and cheating with dishonest scales, buying the poor with silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, selling even the sweepings with the wheat. The Lord has sworn by the pride of Jacob, 'I will never forget anything they have done.'" And so, as you read this passage, his notes, which follow here, that he put into his journal, said that he saw this as the ultimate me-ism, and indicated that, is this not a good picture of where we are in America today? Taking note of the poor only to find better ways to exploit them. Utterly cynical. Their only value was making money. How we treat the poor matters greatly to God. It is a part of the measure by which he judges the land. Then he goes on to say that one of the places I think this attitude shows up is in the debate surrounding raising the minimum wage. And they said, "It seems to me that those who dismiss any thought of raising the minimum wage but take no thought for ameliorating the condition of people who are hardworking but earning too little to provide even a minimal standard of living for their families are taking a moral and spiritual stand, not just an economic one." So it was interesting. Mr. Franklin, is very obvious that he is a person who believes that the minimum wage is indeed a spiritual issue. And so as he shared his thoughts on here about that, it kind of challenged me. My preference is always, like I said, I had an opinion when I read it, And but my challenge has been to go back and to look at Scripture and to find out what it has to say. So I enjoyed the fact that he gave me specific verses here. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go look at those verses. Because like I said, this has become a very big issue around the country. The church in general is becoming more activist in some of these types of things. But my question oftentimes is, is that a good activism? Are we doing the things that God would lead us to or not? And there's a term, you've probably heard it, certainly if you've listened to talk radio, you've heard it called economic justice. And it's a term that's become very popular that talks about the church and a lot of, I won't even go into the denominations, but an effort to try to paint anyone who's done well for themselves with wealth in a good category, and then and really as oppressors of anyone who's not doing well in the country. And while the Bible, I think, makes it pretty clear that's often the case, and we see that right here in Amos, that God is very clearly in favor of the poor and the needy. But we want to dig a little deeper into these verses and see exactly what it's saying. And so we're going to go through some verses today. The challenge with the Bible is the Bible really doesn't have a whole lot to say about wages. I mentioned with abortion that's a terminology you don't find anywhere in the Bible. The Bible doesn't talk about abortion. It does talk about the murder of children. And it's the same here. You'll see some, we're going to talk about some verses, but it doesn't talk about a minimum wage, but it does talk about wages to some degree. So we'll go to the next slide. What I did on this slide is I broke down Amos 8, 4 through 7 just a little to look at some of the things that were highlighted there. So I'm going to read verses 4 and 5 again. So it said, "Hear this, you who trample the needy and do away with the poor of the land, saying, when will the new moon be over that we may sell grain and the Sabbath be ended that we may market wheat?" So part of what's happening here is when the Jews would get together for festivals, there would be limits on what would happen in the marketplace. So the marketplace would be closed down for things like the Sabbath, for things like the New Moon Festival, and the people in the marketplace, the people selling goods, would not be allowed to market. And so one of the things that happened then, and they were generally the wealthier people in the city, they would be agitating, they would be frustrated, they'd be excited for the actual religious celebrations to be over and all that God stuff to be done so they could get back to selling and making more money. And so Amos here is challenging them, and you know, he's speaking on behalf of God, that these people were those who trampled the needy and do away with the poor of the land. They did that by skimping the measure, boosting the price, and cheating with dishonest scales. So a lot of times when they go to the marketplace, you know, we do that now when you go into Smith's or to Harmon's over here, right? There's a measure, there's a scale there, and so if you're buying apples by the pound, you put them on there and you kind of get the general feel for where it's at. So it was the same thing back then, but they would have a scale with a weight, and it was a balance. And so just to kind of make sure, so if this was supposedly 12 ounces and you wanted, you know, whatever their measurement would have been at that time, so they'd put that on there and then stack your grain, and then when it became equal, then they would say that. So they would have lighter balances, though, or lighter weights than what were supposed to be, so that you would not get the full measure of what you were supposed to get. So they were cheating people. So they were skimping the measure. They had dishonest scales. And it says that in verse 6 there at the end that they were selling even the sweepings with the wheat. So, you know, we talk about wheat tares. That's common terminology in the Bible. So the non-wheat, the non-important things for food would be mixed in with the wheat as the sale. So one more way of increasing the weight of what you were given, but decreasing really the effective value of what you got. So we kind of see that in some ways in our grocery store. You go, I just picked up a box of, I can't remember what it was the other day, but I remember specifically as I picked it up, it had this huge box and it was very light. So I was pretty certain that within the box that there was lots and lots of air, but the box was the same as it's always been. But I assumed if I could go back and find one from 5 or 6 years ago, that the weight within it would be considerably different. So, you know, in fairness to our society, at least I know the number of ounces. It's right there on the box. I'm not going to actually compare it. So am I really being cheated? Well, the information's there for me. But, you know, does the box really have to be 4 times bigger than necessary? So maybe it's a marketer taking advantage of me. But those are obvious. Those are dishonest and those are theft. Now, does that tie back to does that tie back to a minimum wage? I would submit that those three do not. That's just dishonest. And does, is God against dishonesty? Is he against taking advantage of the poor or the needy or even the rich in this case through theft and cheating? Because that's really what it is. And I'd say very clearly, yes, God is not in favor of that. The other one, though, that stood out to me was right there at the start of verse 6, and I highlighted it, but it was right here. Buying the poor with silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. So that one took me up for a second. So I was like, okay, buying the poor with silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. What exactly does that mean? And I think what it's indicating there is that the wealthy were manipulating the poor into slavery. And we're going to see, you know, the Bible, slavery is a common, or servants, is common terminology. The Jewish nation had slaves, they had servants. And what we see in the Bible is the common combination of those is into a term called bondservant. And we're going to talk about that in a little more detail in a second. And you know, both of these things would tie back to certainly if the people in the market, if the wealthy were buying the poor with silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, if they were somehow manipulating them into becoming servants or slaves for them through a promise of goods or through the purchase or through purchase with silver, if they were manipulating these people and out of their honest needs, then that may in fact tie into something similar to what we're talking about for a minimum wage. So let's take a quick look at, you go to the next slide, Lisa, some of the things that tie back to slaves and servants. Now this is far from an exhaustive study of, I think you could probably spend a few weeks just going through the how slaves and servants were used within the Old Testament and even the New Testament. So the two definitions that are there are right straight out of Wikipedia. So for slavery, slavery is a system under which people are treated as property to be bought and sold and are forced to work. Servants, slight different variation, is those who perform duties for others, especially a person employed in a house on domestic duties or as a personal attendant. So these are two common terms used throughout the Bible. And you see there's a distinction between slavery and servants if you look at these definitions out of Wikipedia. But as I mentioned, in the Bible, these terms are often brought together into the term bondservant. Now, for the purpose of today, since this is an overview, we will discuss that it's not meant to be, once again, it's not meant to be a full, detailed discussion of slavery under the use of bondservants. It's meant just to kind of provide us some historical context for the discussion on the minimum wage. So a bondservant was an indication that a servant or slave was indentured to a master for a period of time. In the Old Testament, the Jewish nation, that was generally a period of 7 years for a Jew. So if someone was sent into slavery as a servant, at the end of 7 years, in general, that debt was considered paid, regardless of how it had occurred, and that person was returned back to freedom. And so, in general, that was how things worked. Now, there were slaves of other type that ended up enduring long-term into slavery. And so, some of the questions that come out, if you look in through the Bible, how did one become a servant or a slave? Bought and sold. So there's indication that there were people bought and sold into slavery. Sometimes somebody had voluntarily been brought into slavery, and then they were sold to another owner. People who were captives of war were brought into slavery or as servants. A common punishment for theft, someone had stolen, would be to take that person and turn them into a bond servant for the person they had stole from for a period of time. If someone defaulted on debt, once again, so if Keith owed me a lot of money and he was unable to pay, so I was the banker, and so I'd loan him money for his home, then it'd be possible in order to redeem my purchase, he could become, if it was enough, he could become my bond servant for 7 years. And at the end of 7 years, he is returned whole back to being a free man in general. So interesting thing about all this, it wasn't slavery like we see necessarily with the Jewish nation in Egypt, where they were being abused and poorly treated. And so the Bible is very clear that even servants were to be treated well. And here's some of the things about the rights of a servant. So a servant was supposed to be circumcised. This tied back to God's law and making people righteous. They must enjoy religious privileges in their master's household. They must have rest on the Sabbath. They must have that we saw in the New Testament, that slaves or servants would have equal status with other disciples of Jesus. So that slavery or that status as a servant did not automatically disqualify them from being a follower of Christ. That's kind of an obvious thing, but we see that outlined specifically in the Bible. And that kindness was encouraged. And so this just kind of, I think, gives us a picture of slaves and servants. And when we tie that back to the discussion of Amos, so we see that, in fact, if merchants were taking advantage of slaves or people and through silver, so purchasing them for needs, so they were in dire need of food or some other thing, and so they offered them silver if they would become a servant or a slave, they were taking advantage of the poor or the needy. The Bible talks often about taking care of God's requirement that we take care of the poor and that we not oppress or take advantage of the sojourner, the person traveling. So the indication here is in Amos that the merchants were taking advantage of people and drawing them into slavery. And then the other thing they mentioned through a sandal, even something as small as a need for shoes, that they could bring people into a disadvantaged relationship as a result of their needs for something as small as a shoe. And so certainly those would be the kinds of things that we see as far as slavery and servants. But the more I tried to tie that together, I couldn't make that tie back to really anything in there that really brought up the minimum wage. From a biblical perspective, you know, that was fraud, that was cheating and abuse, but it did not tie back to a minimum wage relationship. So we'll go to the next slide. We have a couple other verses. So Leviticus 19:13, the second part of the verse says, "Do not hold back the wages of a hired worker overnight." And then Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 15 says, "Pay them their wages each day before sunset, because they are poor and are counting on it. Otherwise, they may cry out to the Lord against you, and you will be guilty of sin." So a couple of representative verses from the Bible that specifically do talk about wages. So this clarification of his law. So this Leviticus and Deuteronomy. So this is when God was giving Moses and the people of Israel the law, right? So he had told them that he would make them his people if they would agree to follow his laws, all the things that would require them to be perfect, which they signed up for. They were happy to do it. Yeah, great. We'll be your people. And then God gave them all the rules. So these were some of the rules. And you can see from these that times were a little bit different than what we have now, right? So don't hold back the wages of a hired worker overnight. Pay them their wages each day before sunset. Little different picture of the times. So it's clear that certainly the poor, that the wages they received for today, they needed for today in order to provide for that food for that day. And so the way the economy worked then, it was absolutely for those that were the poorest of the laborers, they needed their wages at the end of every day in order to buy food and to provide for their basic needs. So it's not really, we may not necessarily have an equivalent day today, although I'm sure there may be people right now, in the United States or other places where they literally need funding on a day-to-day basis. But in general, culturally, that's not how we do things as far as business. So, right now, there's very few places. I'm sure there are some employers where working people, where they pay them on a day-to-day basis. But in general, people are not paid day-to-day. The other interesting thing you see there is that there are some historical equivalents. So in World War II in Germany, when things started to go poorly for the Germans, they started to hit a period of hyperinflation. So where just money value in the early part of the day, that inflation was going so fast that wages paid in the morning would not even be able to purchase food by the afternoon. And so there's a period of time there where people would literally, they would request their paychecks at lunchtime so they could go buy bread, because if they waited until the end of the day, then they would not be able to buy bread for their families. And that's kind of the picture that we get here. So the poor, they needed those wages. They need them there every day. And so to not pay the poor their wages, if you were somebody hiring labor, would be considered a sin if they cried out to God. And so this is one of those circumstances where I think, the Bible, there are lots of times where I think God lays things on our heart. So what may not necessarily be a sin for me may be a sin for Keith, because God has convicted him about some particular thing. And there's a lot of way that can play out within within the law and the freedom that God gives us through Jesus' death on the cross and our release from the law. Sometimes God will convict you, and it may not be the exact same thing that He convicts someone else about. If you disregard that conviction, if you take advantage of someone, then that could be an issue for you, and that God has drawn you into that relationship. So we see here clearly that wages were different at this period of time. People needed those on a day-to-day basis, and failure to make that payment was problematic. Can you hit the next for me, Lisa? And so in this case, not paying wages would definitely be considered taking advantage of the poor. The other thing that stood out to me on those is that there is an indication, though, that there was some sort of pre-agreed-upon wage. So there's no indication in those verses that the person who hired the people was not paying them what he had agreed. He just wasn't paying them timely. And so I'd assume that if God had considered it a non-agreement, that there would be further differentiation within that. So it looked like they were getting paid where they were supposed to. They just weren't paying them on time. And then one other thing that just stood at me in Genesis chapter 31, verse 41, we see an example here, some verses where Jacob was working for his father-in-law. And at this case, Jacob was interested in one of Laban's daughters. And so he came to an agreement with Laban that if he would work for 1 year, really to establish a dowry, that he would receive the favored daughter as kind of payment for his 7 years of labor. And at the end of 7 years, what happened was that Laban said, oh, and he pulled a slick one on him, and instead of paying his agreed-upon wage, he offered him the daughter that Jacob was not interested in. And so, and then when he went to complain, he said, well, tell you what, for 7 more years of labor, I will give you the daughter that you're interested in. And so after 7 more years, he did receive the love of his life, and then he stayed on for 6 more years in order to gain flocks here. But the interesting thing out of all of that, and I'm just trying to skim to not hit details, is that throughout that time that his father-in-law changed his wages 10 separate times. So we get a picture here of defrauding of Jacob, and in the end it worked out. I think it worked out fairly well for him. But we see, though, that labor and laws definitely is something that has been a concern throughout the Old Testament. And when we change what's been agreed upon, now we're beginning to violate God's laws. And then next slide. Okay, so for this next verse, if you could turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 20, because these are just some excerpts of the story here. And so Matthew chapter 20, verses 1 through 15, it tells us a story. This is a parable told by Jesus. Now, the point of this parable has nothing to do with wages. It just happens to talk about wages as we go through it. And so the parable starts off with Jesus saying, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to them he said, 'You go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you.'" So a couple things from there. So this guy owns a vineyard. So he's the master of a house, and he tells his foreman, "Hey, let's hire some people to go work in the vineyard today." So at the first hour, first thing in the morning, they go to the marketplace where people would show up for their 1 day of labor, and he hires a group of people. And so then later, 3 hours later, so the third hour, he comes back and says, "We need some more people." And so at the first hour, he mentions specifically that they had agreed to labor to him for a denarius a day. So best I could come up with research-wise is, you know, each of the commentators I looked at, a denarius was generally an amount equal to 1 day's worth of wages. So it was kind of a, I don't know how they, doesn't say, indicate how they agreed upon what was 1 day's worth of wages, but the denarius basically was the value of 1 day's labor for a laborer. So at the third hour, he went out and brought some others in. And the interesting thing is at the third hour, and he said to them, "You go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right, I will give you." So they agreed to go and do labor for some unspecified amount, according to this verse. And then it says, in the sixth hour, in the ninth hour, in the 11th hour, he sent his foreman back out to the marketplace and brought more people back to work. Okay, so throughout the day, he continued to bring people in. And then, the we skip to verses 8 through 9. It says, "And when evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, 'Call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last up to the first.' And then those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius." So the guys that had only been laboring at the very end of the day received a full denarius for their labor. And then it says, goes on to say that they paid back, and so each one in reverse of their time, they're from the 11th hour to the 9th hour to the 6th to the 3rd to the 1st, and each laborer received a denarius. Now those men who were hired first were unhappy, because the guys who had only worked an hour, they got a full denarius for their day's labor, and they only received a denarius. So the interesting thing was the master talks with them, and they're upset, and so he says to them, "But did I, see their terminology, did you not agree with me for a denarius?" So they had set a wage, they had set an agreement. Even the guys on the early morning, they were more than willing to labor for the day. The only reason they were unhappy was because other people who hadn't labored as long. So he says, "Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me?" Now the purpose of this parable that Jesus was telling was to talk about salvation, and how that even those who are saved at the very last minute, that they are still saved, that they're going to still enter into the glory of heaven with Christ, but, and it's the same salvation as the guy who was saved as a young child. So the guy that's saved on his deathbed, he comes into the same. It's the same with the thief on the cross next to Christ. So even though he had not been a believer up till then, Christ said to him, "On this day you shall be with me in paradise." So there is no differentiation in salvation. And so the only reason I bring this up, though, is because it does talk about wages. And the interesting thing is that it talks about, did you not agree with me for a denarius? And that ties back to the verses that I showed you in Leviticus and Genesis, talking about where the only issue that was brought up as far as wages was when they were paid, not an established minimum. So it was obvious that the people were free to choose to work for a fee. Any one of these men, and there may have been some, we don't know, that said, I don't want to work for a denarius. Okay. There was no force, there was no pressure put on them. These men agreed. Same thing as we do in the United States. So the fascinating thing for me, from a purely business perspective, is how many people hate Walmart. So they consider Walmart to be an evil oppressor of people. But Walmart does not get to just walk into the church and say, you, let's go. You're going to come work for me today. So the people that work there, or any other business within the United States, do so because they went and they put an application down. They said, "I would like to work for you." And they fill out all this paperwork. They go through an interview process, and they agree to work for a company, and they agree upon a salary. And if they don't like it, and Utah in particular is a state, is a right-to-work state, so which means that at any given day, if I am tired of how things are going, I can quit and walk out. And the law gives me that right. At the same time, as an employer, if Keith works for me, and I've determined that now that he's paid off the 7 years of debt, and then I was going to start paying him, but he's just not really, he hasn't been as motivated now that he's no longer my servant as he was before, so I decide to fire him, but I can fire him right away. So that's in the state of Utah. Every state has some different laws. But and across the board within the United States, that you are free to work. Now, there are illegal activities that happen where people are sold into slavery. That even happens today. So human trafficking is the term that's commonly used for that. The United States is very aggressive in pursuing and prosecuting when that happens. But that is obviously a sin, and it is a crime for which we prosecute those who do not. But in general, we see that in biblical response, that a person could agree to work for a denarius and then and not have to do that. And so the next slide, some things that just kind of stood out to me as I went through this, and I said, this is not all exhausting, but God clearly desires his followers to look out for the interests of the poor. In particular, the orphans and widows stand out as you look in Scripture. And although we didn't go through a lot of verses this week about the requirements for God's people to care about orphans and widows, I think it's one of those things, if you've been spending time in the Word, that comes out frequently. And when we talk about number 8 at some future point in time, we'll talk in great more detail about oppressing the poor and the needy. But really, when it comes to a working relationship and a working agreement outside of a slave or servant type of relationship, which responded, when workers worked for someone else in the Bible, they were paid based off an agreed upon schedule. And it's the same, I think, within the United States. Number 2 is that God promises that He will hold those who take advantage of the poor accountable. This is one of the things that certainly stood out to me as I looked at a lot of verses on oppression. We'll talk about it to greater detail. But ultimately, God says that revenge is mine, saith the Lord, and over, God is who we should cry out to. So many times, I think the church turns back to government as some sort of supplanter or overseer for God. And ultimately, you know, it's easier many times for people to give up their responsibility that we have, the responsibilities God has given us as Christians, turn that over to some government agency. You know what? I don't really need to take care of my parents or my children or you name it, or my neighbors or the widow or the orphans in my church. There's a government agency that can do that. That's not God's intent. God didn't set up governments in order to provide for people. That was the mission of the church. It was our responsibility. Number 3, the other thing that stood out to me, that modern employment is not the equivalent of slavery or servitude. At this point in time, people are free to enter into or leave employment agreements. Number 4, employers have the right to offer a wage appropriate to the task at hand. In fact, they are within their right to be generous. So some employers offer better wages than others, and it ends up being a very competitive field. And some employers, just by the nature of their business, are not able to do so. As I've read through all the challenges on people supporting or against the minimum wage, there are some industries where they are just barely making it. You know, small businesses where they barely make it paying their employees the wages that they do. So the challenge is that if you increase wages, you have to increase the cost of goods. There's a point where people will no longer pay higher goods, so they don't buy your services. And then, if you go out of business, then you're not able to pay your employees at all. So there is a from an economic perspective, a business perspective, there's a challenge there. And then finally, number 5 is employees have the right to not accept the offer of employment at the wage offered. And so, honestly, as I went through all this and kind of came to my conclusion, my point of this was like, so is the minimum wage, is it really a spiritual issue? If you agree or disagree, and I'm not telling you, I think you're free to make your choice on whether you believe in it or not, is the minimum wage a spiritual issue? And the thing that I guess I came up with as I struggle with this really, for the last 4 days and really up until maybe 2 hours before we got here this morning, and God hadn't really laid it on my heart, is it a spiritual issue? And I came up to the answer of yes and no. I don't think that the minimum wage is a spiritual issue for Walmart Corporation. I think Walmart Corporation is a corporation with a specified end state of gaining money. So the wages, they're out to earn a profit for their shareholders as a corporation. Their mission, their job, is to earn a profit for their corporation. And they do so very well. Their job is... And they may consider this part of their responsibilities within a community, but really their end state, their mission is not to provide jobs. Their job is to provide profits for their shareholders, which makes the company more valuable, and people aren't paying 401ks and all that stuff. It goes up. That's what they do in a free market economy. You can argue whether that's the right thing or not, and people argue about that type of thing frequently, but that's their job. Now, if you are Kevin Lee Excavating, I would challenge that as a Christian, if you are a business owner, then the minimum wage may very well be a spiritual issue. It may not be. If you own a small restaurant and all you can afford to pay is the minimum wage, or you will go out of business, and God has not laid on your heart, this goes back to that, it's not going to be an equal thing necessarily, because the Bible hasn't told us. We were listening to a guy not that long ago that was sharing about the Bible. He said, you know, the interesting thing is that when things are really important and they apply to everybody, God took the time and effort to go ahead and write them down in the Bible. So things like abortion and murder and all those things, you don't have to pray about it, whether it's right or wrong. You know it's not. So in a case like this, a lot of times you have to spend some time in prayer and a relationship. So Kevin Lee Excavating is making, you know, $100 million a year by paying their employees the very bare minimum, then maybe there's a problem there. Maybe the employer is truly taking advantage of his employees. And maybe that's something that, as a Christian, the owner of that corporation or that company would look at, is there something I can do better to take care of the people that God has entrusted to me as my employees? And just like the man in Jesus' parable. So he was willing to pay the guy who'd only worked for an hour, the guy on the 11th, the 9th, the 6th, the 3rd hours, to pay them a whole denarius. And even though other people were upset with that, it was entirely within his right to do so. So God had laid upon his heart that maybe the need was to go ahead and pay. But that may not always be the case. It may not even be the possibility for a small employer. So that's where I just finally had to come down on the side of it may or it may not be, depending on your circumstances. Ultimately, though, I hope this wasn't the... I mean, I was also challenged this, especially last night and this morning, trying to put this together of whether it was even a value talking about it, or if it really I was wasting your time this morning to talk through these. But I think these are the things that show up on Benjamin Corey's list are common things now. It's things that we talk about frequently within, maybe not in our church, but it's starting to become more and more a topic of focus for the church as a whole. And, you know, the topic of economic justice and all these types of things. And so I think it's important that we try to go back to the Bible. You know, if the Bible hasn't told us very specifically, many times, you know, our responsibility then is to pray, to find out what we can out of the Bible and pray about it, what God is leading us to do and the choices that God is making for us there. And so that's been the fascinating thing for me to go through that list. Because like I had shared, I mean, I immediately discounted many of the things that were on that list. The more I dug into it, the more challenging it has been as far as looking at that list from a perspective of Christ and our job to share and to witness and to be examples for him. Now, I'll turn it over to Steve. Thank you.